You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. A National Institutes of Health report estimates that 10% of Americans have an issue with substance abuse across the spectrum of their lives. Of those tens of millions of Americans, three-quarters of them never obtain medical treatment. Substance abuse has been a key driver in so-called deaths of despair that seen average life expectancy fall in the United States in three of the past 4 years. The medical profession is no different, with some estimates of the prevalence of substance use disorders exceeding that of the general population. There are many reasons that doctors and other health professionals abuse substances: proximity to drugs, grueling training, and challenging work schedules among them. There's also the issue of stigma. Doctors have to maintain licensure and are asked on a regular basis if they've abused substances or sought mental health counseling, all of which can be an added barrier to seeking help. My guest today, Dr. Adam Hill, is a trained pediatric oncologist who now specializes in hospice and palliative care medicine at Riley Hospital for Children in Indianapolis. He's just written a new memoir about his experiences with addiction, suicidality, and recovery, and has taken the bold step of coming out publicly to encourage the medical profession to stop punishing people for seeking help, counseling, and support. The name of the book is Long Walk Out of the Woods, A Physician's Story of Addiction, Depression, Hope, and Recovery. And it indeed is a hopeful story, including a stint where Dr. Hill worked in Oklahoma. Its author, Adam Hill, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Adam Hill, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by just having you recount your story. It's a very difficult story, one that you wrote about very candidly, and that is suffering with alcoholism to the point where you were pretty depressed and led to a near suicide attempt.
That's right. And, you know, I had really for a long period of time suffered and struggled with anxiety and depression even sort of early on in my life, and it evolved into a medical career, and it did spiral into initially what were attempts for self-medication and numbing myself away from the growing pain and discomfort in my life, and quite rapidly was drinking every night and to even a fifth of vodka every night just to be able to fall asleep, and ultimately led to a place where I saw the only escape from that was to relieve my family and friends from the pain of even having me around and the burden of what I felt I was causing them. And so that was, you know, ultimately where I thought about the end of my own life.
Now, I wanted to ask about the alcohol first, but you noticed, I think, at least in retrospect, that you had a very, I guess, high tolerance for alcohol. You would say where back when you were a teenager, other kids would have one or two drinks or three drinks and lose their inhibitions. You noticed that it took you many more drinks and you had sort of a very large tolerance for that.
Yeah, I think it's true. And, you know, now many years into recovery and sitting in with individuals in recovery and AA meetings, and it's probably not an uncommon story, is what I've learned. And I always had an unhealthy relationship. Not only my tolerance seemed to be different, but the reasons that I drank and used were numbing from social anxiety or angst or just discomfort or feeling different in my own skin. And the alcohol worked, and I developed this relationship even early in my youth and just became more complicated and troubled later on in my life.
Now, when was it that you realized that it was a problem and that you wanted to get help?
Well, the truth, and I think the truth for a lot of people who are really in despair, is that I was in a deep sense of denial and desperation and had really low self-awareness of the depths of which I was struggling until it really was almost too late. And so even in those moments where I was, you know, in active suicidal thoughts and plans, I really had to rely on family and friends. My, you know, the true hero of this story isn't me, it's my wife and my parents and my sister and my friends who really helped me, you know, reached out their hand to get me into treatment and to help and help me to see the next steps ahead, and when I couldn't even see it for myself.
Now, you write very painfully about a time where you were in the parking lot and went into a gun store and tried to buy a pistol or a firearm with which to kill yourself. And I find it very interesting that actually you weren't able to really do that because there was a lot of paperwork. And you didn't really comment it on in the book, but I was wondering your thoughts on if there, you know, was this a waiting period or federally mandated or, you know, if you've reflected on that at all. But, I mean, it seems like that really may have helped save your life.
Yeah, it was actually the process of applying for a gun license and the waiting period. And I do think that, you know, in hindsight, there are many moments of grace that happened in my life that I don't have an explanation for. And I don't pretend to need to have one. But that was one. And where it gave a pause, a momentum shift, enough time for, you know, for me to be able to be saved and helped. And so I did evolve that way.
You decided, I guess, that wasn't going to be the way that you were going to take your own life, but you were going to overdose on pills. And so you walked deeply into the woods, which became sort of the theme or one of the images, in fact, the title of the book, The Long Walk You've Made Out of the Woods to this day. But something stopped you from overdosing on those pills.
Yeah, and, you know, and it was another sort of moment. I'd, you know, set out there in the woods all day long, sitting and sipping and thinking, and really in this deep place of self-deprecation and self-hatred and loathing about everything that had gone wrong in my life, and where, you know, I was out there for most of the entire day and had this growing disconnect in my marriage and with my wife and isolation and us not really communicating. And yet in that moment, she reached out and kept calling me and initially ignored those phone calls. But on the fourth attempt, I finally picked up, and it was just the sincerity of in her voice and just this plead to, and she didn't even know, you know, what I was actively thinking about or planning at the time, but just the sincerity of her voice, and it just called me back home.
Wow. Yeah. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Adam Hill, who is a palliative care physician at Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis. He's author of the new memoir, Long Walk Out of the Woods. It is his, a physician's story of addiction, depression, hope, and recovery. And Adam, you had a critical turning point there that you mentioned when your wife, who you identify as the hero of this story, in a sense rescued you from your own self-doubt and depression and suicidality. And at that point, you decided to get help. And it was a key turning point, I think, in your story because you sought medical help. There was a physician along the way who asked you if you wanted to be quite candid about your alcohol use and abuse. And that wound up having really serious consequences for you and for the rest of your career thus far. Tell us about that decision point.
Yeah, and, you know, I got into psychiatric treatment and mental health therapy and started on an antidepressant and found a recovery community. But it was part of that process, and then I write about in the story, the medical community has a long-standing, complicated relationship with this reporting and disclosure structures of mental health and addiction. And so this primary care physician really had, I think, the purest of intentions in wanting to inform me that, you know, I may have some obstacles and barriers in the way of my future that I'll have to disclose that I was in addiction treatment and mental health treatment on job applications for the rest of my life. But at the same time, you know, sharing that with somebody who's actively suicidal and very fresh into recovery seems like the wrong approach to do. And it's really become a spark and an impetus for me to speak up and share my story, because we have to change that culture so that and change the policies and the structures and how we have approached mental health and addiction in our workforce so that people will feel attracted to recovery and proactive mental health treatment. And a huge calling and mission for me to hopefully not only destigmatize it, but break down some of those obstacles and barriers.
Now, like many doctors who were medical students and residents and fellows, and you did a fellowship both in pediatric oncology, learning how to care for kids with cancer, so very, you know, serious and advanced field, ultimately doing another fellowship in palliative care medicine, where you've learned how to care for those that are suffering in great detail. But you achieved at a very high level. You went to elite institutions, doing a fellowship at Duke University, where a lot of this story took place. And yet you then suffered the consequences of being honest about what you called your Scarlet A, which stood for, at various times, alcoholism or addiction. And ultimately, through triumph and hope, it stands for Adam, which is your name, which I love. But in revealing the fact that you had addiction issues and depression and sought counseling, you did, in fact, wind up losing jobs. So what exactly happened?
You know, to me, I've made mistakes. I'm a flawed human being. I own that I've done things that I had to work and make amends and repair relationships. And I'm imperfect and somebody who's struggled with mental health and addiction. You know, at the same time, I work in a profession who asks people to be vulnerable, patients to be vulnerable and open with their own struggles and come forth to seek help and treatment, and that we have pathways and therapeutic interventions to treat people with mental health and addiction, and yet we've stigmatized our own to the point of closing doors instead of opening ones. I was an individual who came forth proactively for treatment. I didn't have malpractice issues or legal issues or hospital issues. I had still worked pretty functionally and achieved at high levels. When I did disclose, it set forth this cascade of events over the several years to come where it was really hard for me to get a job or, to get credentialed or insured by a malpractice agent agency that would be able to cover me for the services of my employment. So it always struck me as incredibly ironic, but also tragic, not for myself, but that we've done this to individuals when we proclaim that we're have all these therapeutic interventions to help people that are struggling. And that's an incredibly negative tone for the patients, I think, that we serve on a daily basis.
Yeah, so you'd been offered, I think, your dream job. And then while you were going through the process of getting credentialed, you were even working, I think, at the medical center, had your ID badge, but you couldn't see patients yet because the credentialing hadn't come through, and you were called to the boss's office, and you thought, uh-oh, this couldn't be good. And so that conversation was essentially to tell you, I'm sorry, we can't hire you. But I wonder, and you referred to the fact that malpractice insurance wouldn't cover you. That was something that I guess, unfortunately, was surprising to me. I didn't really know. But did it ever get satisfactorily explained to you? I mean, clearly it's not satisfactory in any way, but you thought that, or did anyone ever explain to you just on a statistical basis or why they thought you were too high of a risk if you'd never, had any on-the-job problems before?
Yeah, I think there's been, this blanketed cultural narrative of sensationalization of mental health and addiction that is grass for a long time in Western culture. And, as part of my reporting structure and coming forth, I was labeled a risk to public safety or a liability. And so I think that sometimes individuals on paths of mental health and addiction recovery get railroaded by that narrative as opposed to looking at the facts, which, there's studies that show individuals who are in recovery programs are actually much less likely to be sued than a cohort of their peers, that individuals in recovery have higher levels of empathy and compassion and provide more loving care for their patients, and therefore their patient experiences and patient outcomes are improved. And so I think we've, relied upon this archaic, tired narrative about, a stereotype of what an alcoholic is or what somebody with a mental health condition is, as opposed to really delving into the truth of what we see is that 20% of the general population has some form of mental health condition. You know, 10 million Americans have concurrent mental health and addiction stories, and there are so many people out there on a daily basis that are thriving with those diagnoses, and we should tout that and applaud that as successes of medical treatment as opposed to, you know, punishing it.
Well, after that experience where you were essentially denied the job that you'd been offered, it happened, I think, again. At least you write about it. And then you write about really what you call your exile, and you wound up with a job in, of all places, Oklahoma. So there's an Oklahoma tie to this story. You wound up in Tallahena, Oklahoma, working at Choctaw Medical Center. Tell us how that came about and what that was like.
Yeah, the truth is, you know, as you shared, I was looking for opportunities and had a few doors that shut in my face, and had this connection colleague who reached out with this opportunity. And one of the nice things about working at Choctaw with on federal land was that you can have any state medical license to work on federal land, so you wouldn't have to go through a licensing and credentialing process that could sometimes take 6 or 9 months when you move state to state in medicine. So it was an opportunity, and I was welcomed there, and it was, you know, days before Christmas, and, you know, we had just bought a house and had bills to pay and loans to pay off, and so I felt like at the time it was the only opportunity I had. It ended up being, I write, you know, exile in this conceptualization of what we think is success in academic medicine, you know, from St. Louis University, Duke University, to a small town, which is where I was raised, as some sort of negative connotation. But the truth is, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And being there, I found myself again, and I found the spirit of what it means to be a healer and to connect to patients and colleagues and care about a community, and really found my roots again. And part of the journey of the rest of my life that really is such an incredible blessing.
And I should say, you've had a tremendous amount of success since those days. I mean, you are an award-winning physician. You've won teaching awards. You've won a Distinguished Alumni Award from your university. You're a member of honor societies. You are now, in fact, the division chief of palliative care at the Riley Hospital for Children. And so, in many ways, you've come full circle. You are very successful in this academic medical realm. And it's really, I think, a tribute to your persistence and a perseverance through this illness.
Well, thanks. You know, I appreciate that. I think that I still look at it and approach it one day at a time. And I'm grateful and thankful for recovery and the opportunities that, you know, have been put in front of me. And I don't take any of it for granted, that's for sure. But I've also reached this point in my life, and why I wrote this story and speak about my experience is that, you know, I learned that the only way to keep recovery and sobriety is to give it away and to help other people and to reach people who are suffering and struggling. And that's what I've really sort of pivoted and dedicated a lot of my efforts to over the last few years, because it's such a personal calling for me.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Adam Hill, who is a palliative care physician at Riley Hospital for Children in Indianapolis. He's author of a new memoir called Long Walk Out of the Woods, A Physician's Story of Addiction, Depression, Hope, and Recovery. And Adam, you we talked a little bit about your decision to be open and be transparent and honest with your medical providers, your doctor, your therapist, and in the recovery community. And that did have consequences on your job. But you also had a decision point later on where, once you were back kind of in the midst of academic medicine, you had a decision about whether or not to go public with your addiction history and mental health history. And you decided to go very public by doing what we call a grand rounds. This is the fancy medical name for really a lecture that's given to fellow doctors, as well as trainees, residents, and students, and people from other disciplines. And it's sort of like a once a week kind of big assembly. And I think over 200 people showed up. And you write about being terribly nervous about making this big reveal. But what you ultimately concluded was it was okay to make yourself vulnerable. Well, how did that go?
Yeah, you know, I'd reached this place of peace in my life where I'd honestly had made this decision and supported by my wife that if I ever, you know, needed to walk away from medicine because I couldn't live my authentic true self, then I would. And that was a difficult place to be in, but also gave me such liberation to be able to speak openly and share my story. And really, I needed, you know, to do that to make peace with my own journey. I'd made amends to people across many different walks of my life in the years preceding that, but I don't know that I'd truly forgiven myself and had, you know, a true self-compassion and that sort of liberation. And so part of speaking up and sharing my story was to liberate my story and to reclaim the narrative of it and really ultimately in the hopes that it would reach and help other people that were struggling. But I didn't know. I didn't know how it would be received. And, you know, fortunately, I've been incredibly blessed and loved and supported by a community here at Riley Hospital for Children in Indianapolis and really a community that's now spread throughout the country and even internationally and being connected that really supports this message and supports messages of recovery and medicine. And it's just been an incredible journey in the last few years.
So if you can, frame for us how you view vulnerability. Like most of us, I think, often think of vulnerability as weakness, is that those that are vulnerable might suffer or have harm inflicted upon them. But you view it in a way, you kind of flip it and make it a strength. And I guess if you could kind of share that framework or how you encourage other people to be vulnerable, it's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've always sort of viewed it, and especially in recovery, as this act of leaning in and into a space that is organic and natural to who we are. And, you know, sometimes the greatest opportunities to learn, to grow, evolve, mature, develop, come out of our failures. And so, you know, putting yourself out there with a little bit of social bravery and, you know, exposing yourself sometimes comes with triumphs, sometimes comes with heartache. But I think out of those experiences comes this incredible growth process that allows us to see that, you know, James Joyce said, mistakes are the portals of discovery. And I see it that same way, that I can put myself out there and know that I gave it my best and tried. But you know, and if I fall flat on my face, well, then you get back up and you do it all over again. And so that's been, for me, sort of this personal growth process that's happened. I think for, you know, friends and colleagues and professional communities, I've tried to create organic, safe, natural spaces where people can feel like they can be themselves and share their truth and feel safe in doing so. And that's not just about mental health or addiction, but, you know, about anybody's lived life experience that often faces discrimination or judgment or shame. And we try to do that so that people feel like they can be themselves. And I think there's an incredible beauty and power in that.
You share a couple of instances of patients of yours or family members who know about your sort of public persona now, for whom they reach out to you because of your openness, and it winds up being a therapeutic bond between you and the patients. Does that happen to you a lot?
You know, it actually has happened a fair amount in the last few years. And, you know, I'm really careful. For me personally, the decision has never been about self-disclosure. I never make it about me, and I never bring the topic up to say, like, hey, this is my story, like, this is, but it has. I've had several times when patients themselves or family members or know about or read things that I've written or seen in the newspaper, and it has created this opportunity to have a really truthful conversation about what they may be struggling with, because they see that I very well may understand and have compassion and empathy. And so, it, you know, going through recovery for me has gifted me such a new perspective in life to put myself in somebody else's shoes and to listen longer, to listen harder, to be more caring, to be more understanding, to not assume what somebody's life story is, but really take the time to find out. And being open has just given me so many more opportunities to do so.
And in your recovery, as your career has moved along and you have moved up in academic rank and now run a division, one thing that I was really impressed by is you started essentially a forum at your medical center where people across all the different professions have a chance to talk about suffering or talk about what it is they see on a daily basis in the healthcare environment that can be distressing, morally distressing, or just seeing suffering. And that's really powerful. I mean, how did you even come up with an idea like that?
Yeah, so, you know, we started this project about a year and a half ago and host these events, Compassion Rounds, and it's really been this iteration of not talking about medicine or what it is like working in a medical field. It's not about patients or taking care of, other individuals. It's about our own human stories and how we can build community and connection within the hospital walls. And so we invite everybody from, you know, our cafeteria workers, environmental service workers, to administrative assistants, to our security guards, to doctors, nurses, therapists, and the like. And it's really about building a space for connection. And so what we do is we host these events and invite our colleagues to speak and share, and sometimes on really powerful things like being survivors of child abuse or having a history of PTSD or having anxiety disorders or, you know, in addiction recovery. Sometimes it's about grief and loss and tragedy. We lost a dear friend and colleague of mine a few years ago, unexpectedly, suddenly, from type 1 diabetes. And the profound loss that was in our institution went overnight. You know, she was no longer here, and invited her sister to speak and share. And it was just this powerful moment of healing and closure and processing and that occurred that we needed. And so we try to just invite spaces for human stories to be told so that people in the audience can see and identify with the storytellers and say, you know what, there's a piece of that story in me too. And then now I have somebody I could look to and identify with and mentor or just even connect to so that we don't feel so isolated and alone in the gravity of what we do on a daily basis.
I just think that's really wonderful. And I wish every medical center offered that type of sharing experience. Well, it's a gripping memoir, and it has some dark spots, but it definitely ends on a note of hope and recovery. It is called Long Walk Out of the Woods, A Physician's Story of Addiction, Depression, Hope, and Recovery. And that physician is my guest today, Dr. Adam Hill, who is a palliative care physician at Riley Children's Hospital in Indianapolis. Adam Hill, thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you so much.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.